Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. You've heard the names, maybe even tried the South Beach diet, the Atkins diet, the grapefruit diet. One diet, fad or another, is always making the rounds, after all. But is the diet fad as a trend on the way out? One study released earlier this month found evidence that it is, that Americans are dieting less. Joining us now to talk about that is Harry Balzer. He studies eating trends as chief analyst and vice president of the NPD Group. Welcome to the show, Harry.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you. When I told my trainer this morning that your research has found that dieting is not as prevalent in the U.S. as it has been in the past, she sort of scoffed. I don't know if she was surprised or not, but she says it doesn't look like people are dieting as much as they used to.
It certainly has that feel, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But we've been collecting data. My real function is to watch how people eat.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I really do. I'm a researcher who tracks how people eat. And I ask people to keep, throughout the United States, I ask people to keep a 14-day diary of all the foods and beverages they consume. But after they complete that 14th diary, I come and ask them, were you on a diet during those 2 weeks? And we're doing this every week. There's a sample throughout the United States who's keeping a two-week diary. But it's that question, are you on a diet these last 2 weeks? Because I want to know if the foods were different if you were on a diet. So it's weekly information that we've been collecting for, this is probably 30 years now that we've been collecting this data. And at one point, we would get around 30, 34, 35% of the population. If you're male, it was lower. If it's female, higher. Saying, yep, during that two-week period, I was on a diet. Last year, the number was like, I think it was 23 for women, 17 for men. I think the average is about 20%. I just have fewer people reporting, telling me the 2 weeks of behavior they gave me, they would be calling it a diet.
Now, if you asked me to keep track of what I eat for 2 weeks, I'd go on a diet just so I wouldn't embarrass myself.
That's a funny thing you say that, Dan, because that is the single biggest concern that we have, is that keeping the record will alter your behavior. And so the way we try to get around that is we have you keep the record for one day and mail it into us, or send it into us,
mm-hmm.
so that you're not looking over the 14 days.
Mm.
Now, we always have this concern about are people going to tell us what they want to tell us?
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is, the issue is not whether you're going to lie or not lie. It's, are you going to report or not report? So you oversample to make sure you get enough people reporting to you, telling you the 2 weeks of behavior they have. But at the end of that 2 weeks, I come back and ask the same question I've been asking for 30 years. Are you or are you not on a diet during those that two-week period you gave me information?
I was fascinated that your research also has shown that our ideas about what is an attractive weight have shifted. And I was wondering, is this a good, when we look at that, are we saying that we're more comfortable not being super skinny or we're more comfortable being heavier?
Hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question that I really never liked the question, but it was one that we began asking 30 years ago. And the way the question is phrased is, people who are not overweight look a lot more attractive. Do you agree with that? People who are not overweight look a lot more attractive. If you agree with it, then I'll just track that over time. And in 1985, the very first year we asked this question, we had 55% of the adults saying, I agree, if you are not overweight, you look a lot more attractive. Now, as the country became overweight and put on more weight, the percent of the population that agreed with that statement declined. So right now, we're at one of the lowest levels. We're at 23% last year said that I agree with the statement that people who are not overweight look a lot more attractive. In other words, as we become overweight, I think we've become accepting of this. So it doesn't surprise me that I have fewer people telling me they're on a diet. Because I think that this is the way we've kind of justified what's happened to us, is that we've become more acceptable.
Before we go on, just want to remind listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Harry Balzer. He's chief analyst and vice president of the NPD Group, and he studies how people eat. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this change and these changes aren't necessarily from a nutritional or healthy point of view coming. They're not necessarily coming from a good place, you're saying. It's just we're adapting to heavier bodies, both in how we think about them and view them and in terms of how we react to them.
You know, what I like to do is just collect information, let others feel to interpret that data. But the truth of the matter is I get, after I ask you the question, were you on a diet, I ask you another two questions. What's your height and weight? So I can calculate the body mass index. So I can track that over time as well. And I can see that I get a greater percent of the adults telling me height and weight measurements that would give a body mass index would be over 25. Mm-hmm. And that's been consistently moving upwards. So if you put these all together, I think this is always about the one thing that I have viewed in our eating habits that is a primary driver for how we will change, which is always about time and money.
There are alternative explanations that we're just eating healthier and not calling it a diet, that the semantics have changed. Is that, do you check for that?
We don't. But that's not to say that's not happening, because I do ask one more question. I ask lots of questions, actually, but there's one more question that's relevant here. And that's, we ask, how do you feel about this question? I would like to lose 20 pounds. Yes or no? And the percent that say I would like to lose 20 pounds is about 60% of the adult population. So I'd like to lose 20 pounds. That number hasn't changed in 15 years. Hmm. So I have 20% of the population on a diet, but I have 60% saying I'd like to lose 20 pounds. So there is this possibility that you're always on a diet, even though you don't call it a diet. You're always watching what you eat. That's a possibility. But I do know the country is heavier than it was when we first started collecting data.
And still, you told the Huffington Post that this is not the death knell for the diet industry, that it's actually growing by leaps and bounds.
Well, the percent of the population that is on a diet is still very large. This is 20% of the adult population. They're still interested in looking for ways to lose that 20 pounds, even beyond the people who are dieting. There's no question about it. Dieting will be around, and diet plans will be around as well. In fact, Ann, do you have an idea what the number one diet is in America?
No.
It's my own diet. We ask everybody, okay, what kind of diet were you on? And by far, by a margin of 3-1 over the next biggest diet is going to be the one that I created, my own diet.
What about doctor-supervised diets?
Well, actually, a doctor-supervised would be, as an idea, would be the second most popular diet. In other words, you've been told by a doctor, you've been advised by a doctor, or you're following doctor advice mm-hmm. on how to diet, which seems to be, that would be a strong one. Would have anything to do with whether how you feel about that word diet. It is given to you as this is the behavior that you have to start modifying, you have to start changing. And that, too, has been going down. Matter of fact, that one is of more concern to me than how you feel about the word dieting, because it seems to suggest to me, and it's moved in the same kinds of levels as individual choice diets. It seems to me, though, that either the doctors are not involved in the diet discussion as much, or you're just not listening to them. But for whatever reason, I'm getting fewer people telling me that they are following a doctor-supervised diet.
So you said my diet is the number one diet. What are the popular diets out there?
Well, Weight Watchers would be the most popular by far. Weight Watchers is the most popular diet that's a commercial plan. But you'd have all the ones you know, Jenny Craig, Nutrisystem, and then there's some that are branded ones. Like there's a Special K diet or a Slim Fast diet.
Can't pinch an inch.
There are diets, and the list of diets goes on. I mean, I laugh because we have diets that I think are probably 30 years old that people still say, yeah, I'm aware of it. I haven't followed it recently. So that there are lots of diets. Matter of fact, diets are kind of like the new product in the eating area. So what's the latest diet? What's the latest thing that we're going to be following? As a matter of fact, yeah, my job is to watch how people eat. Every other week, we ask 1,000 adults, what diet are you on? Because we're waiting to find the next new diet.
What about gender and age differences? What about the demographics? Does that reveal anything about this downturn in the number of people who identify themselves as dieting?
Not really. It doesn't reveal anything in that downturn, but it reveals something about dieting. In other words, and this is another thing that you learn as you watch how people behave for 30 years, as I have, at least with regards to this one activity, eating, is that the trend in fewer people dieting occurs across all age groups, men and women. It doesn't really matter. We are more alike than we are different, but the trends change. But as you get older, you are more likely to be on a diet than if you were younger. So the people who are most committed to dieting actually are older Americans. You'll reach a point over 65 where you'll be on a diet and it'd be no different than if you were 55. You're just constantly on a diet.
But you could say it could be a diet just saying that you're on a low salt diet.
Sure.
It might not have anything to do with weight per se, but about some other physical issue.
Absolutely. But I will tell you, it's about 90% of all diets are for weight loss problems.
I keep trying to talk us out of this.
We're looking for those answers.
There's this tone of desperation in my voice. And I don't know. We have an email from Samantha. I have checked my BMI, and it shows that I am, quote, overweight, end quote. I am 5'5 and weigh about 160. My BMI should be under 25, but it is 26.5. When I told my friends that I am overweight, they all yelled at me, saying that I look great and there is no way that I am overweight. Is it just that I am carrying the weight well?
You know, those are issues I won't even touch.
Right. But it is interesting, though.
But I will say that BMI has come under a lot of question.
Okay.
Is that the only measurement of being fit or being healthy? And even recently, there's been some issues about that number and what is overweight or not being overweight. But for our purposes, it is a fixed number. So we can watch how the population moves around that number. Whether you like the number or not, it's another story. But it is a fixed number so that I can take people who I have information from 20 years ago and look at what their height and weight was and compare it to the height and weight of people today and determine, has the number changed? And then we can explore, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Over the course of 30 years, you've seen the weights go up across the board, right?
That's true.
Any other correlations that are interesting to you regarding that?
You know, we have always looked at what role does a healthy diet play in the foods and beverages you choose. And the thing that has always interested me about this is that it's always a secondary issue. The primary issues are, what's it taste like? Is it available? What's it cost? How easy is it to prepare? What's the general appeal of this to the rest of the family or people I'm with? And then secondarily, it becomes, is it healthy? Whereas a lot of people think that everything is done for health. For the most part, it's not. For the most part, it's done for taste, time, money.
What about processed foods? That's changed a lot in 30 years.
It's, again, from the perspective of just watching how people eat, the area that has changed the most is that we tend to make fewer foods
right. In
this country. Matter of fact, the growth of the big change in the American diet. Well, nothing has changed in the American diet as a population than yogurt. Yogurt is the food of the decade, maybe the food of the last two decades.
It takes up a whole shelf. I mean, a whole section of the grocery store now.
And imagine what this might have looked like 20 years ago, that section.
Right.
That it has truly been the food that more Americans now have a part of their diet than any other food compared to 10 years ago. And I think if you look at yogurt, you ask, what does it say about us? Well, this issue about I'd like to lose 20 pounds. Well, yogurt will fit into that, won't it? Yogurt can be breakfast. It can be lunch. It can be supper. You know, I really don't want to cook. And what are the cooking instructions for yogurt? Open. You know, what's the cleanup instructions? Clean the spoon? I got to clean the spoon? It says so much. And then on top of all of this, it can be the main dish. It can be the dessert. It can be a snack. Matter of fact, the fastest growing dessert in American homes today is a cup of yogurt. This is a wonderful product that says so much about where we want to go. But the beauty of yogurt is it requires no cooking. And on top of that, I think it's healthy. I think it's good for me.
Unless
whether
you're
it is or isn't, it doesn't say anything to it. But I think it's good for me.
Well, Harry Balzer, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll join us again.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Harry Balzer is chief analyst and vice president of the MPD Group. They've been studying what Americans eat for 30 years now. Coming up, we're going to change topics and move on to cancer. The latest research in cancer, and also talk about the healthcare system in the United States. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
An aggressive agenda for the second Obama administration. House Republicans retreat to Williamsburg and punt the debt ceiling 3 months down the road. The outgoing Secretary of State testifies on Benghazi, while John Kerry's nomination as her successor goes before the Senate committee he chairs. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 15 degrees. Some snow showers expected this afternoon, about a half an inch of accumulation. Another inch of snow is possible tonight, a low of 11 degrees. Mostly sunny with a high of 22 on Thursday. Support comes from ARC Industries, creating employment opportunities for people with disabilities and helping businesses grow their own inclusive workforce. ARC is dedicated to the success of its customers and employees and believes our community is at its best when we are all working together. Online at arcind.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. Few argue about the problem. Our current healthcare system doesn't work. The costs are rising and the quality isn't always what it should be. David Goldhill learned this the hard way when his otherwise healthy father caught pneumonia, checked into a hospital, and then died tragically weeks later from unrelated infections. That tragedy inspired David's close look at the system and his new book. It's called Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
Your research and subsequent book were inspired by the really tragic death of your father. It was just a matter of weeks. But you kick off the book with a story about a young woman who works for your company. Why a healthy young person?
Well, because I think one of the things that our system is based on is an illusion that somebody else is paying for our care. And as the system's gotten more and more expensive and more wasteful, that's important because we don't realize how much we're each bearing to pay for this healthcare system. I start my book off by looking at an entry-level employee here who's 23 years old and is earning $35,000 a year, which is not a great salary in New York, but isn't that far from the median national income. And I look at what the cost of the healthcare system will be over her lifetime, how much she will bear. And just to give you some big, broad numbers, assuming that there is zero increase in cost, zero, over her entire lifetime in healthcare costs, she will bear $1.1 million as the breadwinner of her family in healthcare costs. That's all her contributions into the system from insurance premiums and Medicare premiums and taxes. If you just adjust that number for the growth in healthcare expected under the Affordable Care Act, if the act is successful, it's $1.9 million. And you think of a 23-year-old woman, and I make a couple of major assumptions about her life, that she never gets rich, and she never gets sick, never really sick. That's an extraordinary burden to place on our young people, and yet that's a burden placed on every young person entering our workforce.
Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act. It hasn't gone into really completely into it hasn't been set into motion completely yet, and it'll be a few years before it is. But your book, you know, has come out since it's brand new, and it's of course come out since the law was passed. So I assume it doesn't measure up. Are you an anti healthcare reform, or do you think it didn't go far enough?
Well, you know, this book is a little different than the political debates we've been having about healthcare reform, which have mostly centered around how do we make sure everybody's included in the system? How do we make sure everybody's insured? I think that's a worthwhile goal, but I think it misses the core problems in healthcare. The core problems in healthcare is we have a system that's incented to produce waste, very high cost, very poor service, as you can see if you ever enter a hospital. I just took my son for an emergency appendectomy last month, and the service is unbelievable compared to anything else in our world. And then, as in the case of my father, often dangerously sloppy. And really what I look at is I step back from the political debates and say, why is the system incented to have such terrible performance? Why are the incentives so perverse? And what do we do about it? And so the look at the Affordable Care Act is less about the should we have insured everyone or should we not have insured everyone, and more about does it really get at the fundamental problems that affect the way we as patients all experience healthcare?
You consider healthcare as a business and say that if it was a regular business, you know, like ordinary businesses, it would have gone out of business a long time ago.
Well, and I mean, you mentioned that my interest in the subject started with my dad's death 5 mm-hmm. years ago. And apart from the fact that 100,000 Americans each year are killed by infections they acquire in a hospital, and that most, not all, but most of those infections are fairly easily preventable. And then you spend time with a loved one in a hospital, and you see your loved one taken for procedures that were really meant for other patients, and the files lost, and doctors who don't confuse them with someone else down the hall, and nurses who, you know, are overstretched and don't have the time to deal with even some basic needs. And what you realize is that we have, as customers, not just as patients, have given the whole thing a pass in a way that we don't give everything else a pass in life. We just sort of all shrug our shoulders and say, well, it's healthcare, that's the way it is. And what my book is about is, well, no, that's not the way it is. In fact, there's no industry where quality should have been improved more by technology than healthcare. There's no industry in which service should have been benefited from the rise in information technology. The reason these things haven't happened is not because it's healthcare. It's because we've structured this business, this industry, so differently than anything else that it lacks the accountability that everything else has.
And structured meaning that we have this big middleman called insurance.
We have a middleman for everything in healthcare, whether it's an insurer, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's a regulator. We think we're getting a lot of benefits from these middlemen. We think that they're more efficient, they're better at negotiating prices, that they're providing us financial security. What the book does, looking at Becky, who is this 23-year-old who's a real person, is point out that we're not actually getting any of these things, that in fact, the agenda, the incentives that the middlemen impose on the system are very different from what ours would be. And the only reason we tolerate it is we have this illusion that someone else is actually paying for it. Once I think most people realize how much money almost everybody is putting into the healthcare system, then that thought about are we really getting the type of performance, the type of quality, the type of safety that we expect probably comes more to the forefront.
You make the point that to figure out how important all of this is to us is to just consider how many people say, well, I took the job for the benefits.
It is extraordinary. I mean, I see it as an employer. My company has about 300 employees, and I know it's one of the things the Affordable Care Act hopes to affect, but I'm quite suspicious that those goals will be achieved. The number of people who make their decisions about jobs, careers, opportunities based on healthcare benefits is extraordinary. And what it means is that we've taken these tremendous fundamental problems we have in healthcare, and we've allowed them to infect, you know, even the job creation machine in our economy. I refer to healthcare several times as the beast in the book because it's gobbling up more and more resources. And interestingly, it's gobbling up resources at the expense of our health. I mean, the big indicators in health in a society are income and education and lifestyle and stress levels and, you know, recreational opportunities. Well, all those priorities in our country and in other countries get less and less resources as we pour more and more resources into healthcare. So it's dangerous on the personal level, and on the national level, it's a reordering of priorities that's making us less healthy.
My guest is David Goldhill. He's written a book. It's called Catastrophic Care: How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. If you have a question for David, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You posed a striking example of the disconnect, comparing the American military deaths in the Iran and Afghanistan wars with the Medicare hospital patient deaths.
It's a very uncomfortable analogy to make, but you know, one of the issues we have with excess medicine and sloppy medicine is that our seniors are hospitalized at a very high rate, and also suffer, like my father did, harm from many of those hospitalizations. So, depending on how measured, somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 7 admissions leads to some sort of harm from an error. The rate of death from accident is just under 1% of admissions. And to put some perspective on just how high that rate from accidental death is, I did point out that even if you look at the troops that served in Afghanistan and Iraq, their rate of death was less than our seniors' rate of death from accidents in hospitals. It's a chilling statistic when you think about, you know, we're sending these young people off to the most dangerous imaginable occupation to serve our country, and seniors in hospitals face even greater danger from accident.
You're concerned about our focus on preventative care, and I wanted first for you to define what do you mean by preventative care?
Well, I think it's interesting because what I mean by preventive care increasingly is what the government is now willing to pay or insist insurers pay 100% for. One of the points of the book is that we as a society have said, any health care you need, we will subsidize. Medicare and Medicaid say any health care you need, we will pay for. What we don't seem to focus on is that healthcare is an industry. And so the industry's reaction to that is, let's keep defining more broadly what people need. I mean, the reality is over the last 50 years, people have gotten a lot healthier. We drink less, we smoke less, we're in less dangerous jobs, we are wealthier than we were 50 years ago. All the real indicators of health suggest we're healthier. But if you look at how much healthcare we use, it endlessly increases. The volume, just the pure volume of care goes up. And, you know, the major reason for that is we've incented an industry to find things that are useful, and we redefine useful as need. I think healthcare is changing in a lot of ways that we haven't noticed since we and other nations decided to start subsidizing all of it. And this is an area that is classic. I mean, if I go to my insurer's website, it suggests 22 tests I take on a regular basis. Well, fortunately, almost all of those tests are going to be negative for almost all of us every year. Not necessarily a bad thing to do, although some of those tests do expose you to radiation. But on the other hand, not the kind of thing we would do compared to all the other goals we have in society unless we thought someone else was paying for it. And so it's a very distortive influence on our decisions and on what society is spending money on, which increasingly is more and more healthcare.
Adam in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Adam.
Hi. I'm actually a nurse, one of those overstretched nurses that works in an emergency department in Columbus. The customer service end of things, we do have press gaining surveys that we are constantly, I think quarterly, updated on about how we're doing. I mean, we're very aware of how patients view the wait in an emergency room, and I know they consider waiting several hours to be unacceptable. If you were at, you know, a restaurant or some other service place, you might not accept that, but it's not Burger King. You can't have it your way all the time. The customer is not always right in this case.
David?
Well, I think actually that's a very good point. I mean, one of the things you see when you're an outsider looking at healthcare is you don't see the villains that the political system looks for. You see people genuinely trying to do the best they can. What you see is systemic problems. So, and you see this two ways, right? You see this as a patient walking into a hospital, as I did a month ago, and being asked to fill out the same 7-page form twice in 10 minutes while you have a child who needs emergency surgery. That's just absurd, right? We wouldn't accept that in a grocery store, filling out the same form twice in 10 minutes in the same building. And then you see it at the big level, right? There was a RAND report on information technology and healthcare released in this past month that said that the $45 billion this country has spent on information technology had no meaningful impact because hospitals and other providers bought equipment that was interoperable or didn't provide expanded service or really hadn't changed the patient experience. And what I'm talking about, and it's very hard for people to understand, is there's a reason that systemically hospitals have done a poor job of using information technology to improve the patient experience, and your auto mechanic and your dry cleaner and your corner grocery and every other person you deal with, FedEx, Amazon, you name it, has figured this out. It's not because the people are bad in healthcare. It's not because they're not trying. It's because the incentives in the system are very perverse. They are the opposite of what we as patients want. It's the reason there's 310 million people in this country, and every single one of them has a story about healthcare that they have about nothing else.
Well, and filling out paperwork is annoying to do, but again, you're not going to know that that your son needed emergency surgery within 45 minutes. There is time to do that.
Yeah, no, I may not be expressing the point correctly. I had to fill out the same form twice in 10 minutes because the surgery department and the CAT scan department in the same hospital, separated by four forms, had no technological way of sharing that information. That's not the case in any other institution in America.
Except high school. Adam, thanks for your call. I want to try to squeeze one more in. Thank you very much. Charles in Springfield, you're on the air. Charles, welcome.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm pretty much for the new health care system. What I've seen, well, I'm fortunate I do have a good health care, you know, insurance for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that with my adult children, some of them who are employed can't afford the health care. But what I've noticed in my situation is that I'll get this outrageous bill for hospital care or emergency room care, but my insurance seems to negotiate it way down. So they might be asking for $2,000, but my insurance negotiates down to $800. So where it puts me at is in that thought that the healthcare system, you know, needs to be restructured from the fact that people who don't have healthcare insurance end up with these outrageous bills that they can't negotiate. So I wanted to get his thought on that.
Well, thanks. It's an excellent point, and it's a symptom of a very big issue in healthcare, which is the prices have no meaning in any sense that we understand. And no price on a healthcare bill is ever paid by anybody. For my father's treatment, we got a statement through Medicare that said the bill was $650,000, of which my mother's share was $993. So in the book, I did a little experiment. I said, what if instead of putting my father at that hospital, we put him at the most expensive hotel in New York? And we gave him, we leased all the hospital equipment. So we put $1.5 million of hospital equipment in his room. I gave him 24-hour-a-day nursing, 2 hours a day with doctors, which is about an hour and 50 minutes more than you get in the hospital. Room service for his meals, everything else. I got to $200,000. That's basically building a hospital room from scratch in the most expensive hotel in the most expensive city in the country. The Medicare bill, again, for that service was $650,000. Now, again, that's not what Medicare paid. Your insurer pays nowhere near that. And one of the ways the system works, one of the reasons that we continue to support this thing, is we actually are supposed to feel grateful that we all paid. Family insurance policy of my company this year is $24,000 in premiums. So you pay $24,000 in premiums, you go have some procedure. They tell you the procedure would have cost you $40,000. Your insurer paid $6,000 or $7,000, and you're somehow supposed to be grateful that you put up $24,000 to get $7,000 back, but you avoided paying for it. All the money is just, it's complete nonsense. It's complete fiction. And that's a big problem. So that we sit around, we have no idea of cost. We don't even know what we're paying. And that's why I start my book, as you mentioned, by looking at what a young woman starting out today is actually paying out of her pocket. Forget the fictitious bills and the nonsense of reimbursement. What is actually going to come out of her income over her lifetime? Right now, for someone starting out in the workforce, if they're insured, 25% to 30% of what they earn over their lifetime, what their employer pays them, is going to go into the system. That's an unsupportable burden today.
Charles, thanks a lot for that.
If your father hadn't had the insurance.
Charles, yes, we need to move on. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Thank you.
I wanted to get something really quickly. We did have someone on Facebook ask if you could give advice on how to pick a better doctor and hospital, and I thought we could just cut to your pledges that you would like your readers to make.
Well, I think on hospitals, there's something very important that every listener should know about, which is the Leapfrog group, which is the big employer hospital safety group, has just issued grades for all hospitals on safety measures. So there's a number of measures of safety performance at hospitals. Leapfrog has compared it all and translated into A, B, C, and F grades. And I really would urge any of your listeners, before they go into a hospital, to look at those grades. I think that's most important. And I think the other thing is, you know, we're going to see increasing numbers of people who are either not insured or have very high deductibles. And, you know, for better or worse, they need to think of themselves as customers. I've been uninsured for some part of my life. And what you'll find is that the healthcare system, if forced to, will react like other suppliers will. They'll negotiate with you. They negotiate with their insurers all the time. You've got to be an aggressive consumer. Unfortunately, a more consumer-driven system would cause them to chase us in a way that other companies do. But that's not the system we have in this country, at least not yet.
David Goldhill, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the time, man.
David Goldhill, he's the author of a new book. It's called Catastrophic Care, How American Healthcare Killed My Father and How We Can Fix It. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the latest in cancer research. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Jimmy Kimmel talks with us about his new time slot at 11:35, the David Letterman Club he founded as a kid, and his early career in radio. So Jimmy Kimmel started in public radio.
That's right, and graduated to the public toilet.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 17 degrees with a high of 19 today. Expect some snow showers late this afternoon, less than half an inch of accumulation. Another inch of snow is possible for tonight, probably a little less, a low of 11 degrees. And then mostly sunny and a high of 22 on Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. The American Cancer Society predicts that in 2013, more than 66,000 new cases of cancer will be diagnosed in the state of Ohio. Meanwhile, millions upon millions are spent every year to cure and treat the myriad cancers. Since 1946, it is said that the American Cancer Society has invested more than $2 billion in research trying to find a cure. Institutes and universities around the world are battling the diseases as well. So what's new? Joining us now to talk about the latest advances in the future of treatment and prevention of cancer is Dr. Michael Caligiuri, among other things, the director of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center and CEO of the James Cancer Hospital and Soloff Research Institute. Dr. Caligiuri is speaking on this topic tomorrow at OSU in a free event. So for more information, visit WOSU.org/allsides and check out the link we have there. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Caligiuri.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So cancer is the leading cause of death, but there are lots of cancers. I was wondering if you could start out the conversation with talking about how the research community goes about deciding what gets attention.
Oh, that's a great question. And the answer is it's complex. But I think I could just start at the top and might be something I go back to over and over again. Mm-hmm. A lot of what gets done is funded. So it all comes down to the money, like so many other things. And a lot of what gets the money does depend on our federal representatives. You know, if you're very interested in seeing more research done in a rare tumor, in prostate cancer and breast cancer, colon, brain, it's very important to let your federal representatives, that is your state senator and your congressman, know that this is important to you. So we don't decide, we the researchers, the government, our federal government decides where the money's going to be, and that's where we as researchers go.
Which makes me wonder how often somebody gets a great idea that doesn't go anywhere because there's no funding.
That's why we started Pelotonia, because so often our young people are not getting federal funding, because federal funding for cancer research and for biomedical research in general has been flatlined for over 6 years now. And with inflation, it actually goes down. So while people like myself, who are well-established scientists and physicians, get funded still, I'm 57. People who are, you know, 47, 37, 27 aren't getting funded. And they're leaving the field, which is very bad for us and the future of our future and the future of our children and grandchildren. We need these young, great, inspired minds in the field. So we started Pelotonia to literally take 100% of all the money raised and fuel the passion, the great ideas of the next generation so that they're inspired to stay in the game until federal funding for cancer research gets better.
In 2011, you wrote an opinion piece for the Dispatch that said that cancer research is too important to cut. And back then, Congress was debating the 2012 appropriations. Going forward, that debate without resolution continues. Is the same opinion piece still in order?
Oh, absolutely. Now more than ever. You know, the irony is, and that if we spent a little more money on research, we'd spend a lot less money providing care, because we would develop the early detection, the outstanding imaging, the genomics that predict who will and will not get certain diseases. So research ultimately drives costs down, not up. But to many of our representatives, and I understand they get hit with a lot of different things, you know, it's another cost. But in fact, it's a wise choice to make. Research ultimately prevents disease. And, there's the saying, if you think research is expensive, try disease. Disease is much more expensive to treat than is the research to prevent the disease.
My guest is Dr. Michael Caligiuri, director of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. If you have a question or comment for him, we're talking about big breakthroughs in cancer research. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what were the biggest breakthroughs in cancer research? Was it in prevention, treatment, cures? Tell me what has you excited.
I think the biggest breakthrough that's come over the last several years is that there's really no such thing as a routine cancer. If 10 people listening all have lung cancer, at the DNA level, the cause at the DNA level is likely different in all 10 of those people. So it's no longer routine for us to think about a single treatment, when in fact the thing that gave us the cancer, the lung cancer in the first place, wasn't the same. And that's true for colon cancer. It's true for breast cancer, prostate cancer, all cancers. They have many, many different causes at the gene level. In other words, cancer cells do not stop dividing. Your normal cells divide, they stop dividing, and they divide again, and they stop dividing. They're very regulated, but cancer cells just keep dividing. And the switch that is stuck in the on position for your cancer versus my cancer versus another person's cancer is different in every individual. And so we now know that every cancer is different, and we have the tools to really detect what the cause is in one kind of cancer versus another, and those tools are getting better and better. That's where the breakthroughs are coming, the ability to analyze each tumor individually and come up with individual treatments.
What about breakthroughs in treatments, though? Because if you have that many different causes, doesn't it affect, or is it just a matter of tweaking the treatments?
No, they're very different treatments.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you're not hearing, we've cured lung cancer. But in fact, we now have pills and antibodies that you give through the veins that are not traditional chemotherapy that can put people with, you know, what was universally fatal lung cancer into complete remissions now, but it's a small fraction of those lung cancers. It's only those ones that have a specific genetic defect. So you're not going to hear, we've cured breast cancer, we've cured prostate cancer. What you're going to hear is, we now have a treatment which successfully treats 10% of prostate cancers, or 4% of breast cancers. Because in fact, 100 breast cancers, there's going to be, you know, 20, 30 different causes. So it's happening, and we're making progress. And there are 12 million people in America cured of cancer, 12,000 alone from the James Cancer Hospital and Solof Research Institute. But it's happening smaller, quietly, because there are so many causes. It's how we say it's different from treating pneumonia. The pneumococcal bug is what causes pneumococcal pneumonia. It's one bug. It's the same. If we all have pneumococcal pneumonia, we have the same bug and we have the same treatment. In cancer, it's very different. Each tumor may look the same on an X-ray, but at the genetic level, the cause is very different, and therefore the treatment is very different.
When there's this kind of a breakthrough, how does that change? We were talking about funding for research. Is there a ripple effect out in the community when now you're deciding that we're not just talking about curing one kind of cancer, we're talking about curing many kinds just when we're talking about lung cancer?
Well, we're certainly at the James, we have 300 cancer researchers, and we work on every single type of cancer. There's somebody doing research on it, and if it's not being funded by the federal government, we're funding it through Pelotonia, through the philanthropic support we receive from incredibly generous donors in the Ohio community. So we're working on every type of cancer. In fact, we have 140 cancer physicians, and every one of those cancer physicians works on one specific tumor. So they teach it, they do research on it, they lecture around the world in it, and they treat patients in it. So we don't stop regardless of whether the federal government's funding or regardless if there's one cause or 20 causes.
Mm-hmm.
We're very, very focused, very, very subspecialized. Each person does one cancer. So we're making progress on all fronts. That's, I think, critical for our listeners to understand.
Does it matter how many people are affected by that cancer?
No, not
okay.
at all.
All right.
We actually are just starting a rare tumor clinic. So where it's, you know, 1 in 200,000 people, we're starting a rare tumor clinic for that precise reason. And what we're doing is we're getting a piece of those rare tumors, sequencing the DNA, and seeing what drugs that we have available in our armamentarium that might specifically target that tumor, rare tumor, even though it's never been reported.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Caligiuri of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome.
Hi, this is Mike.
Yep.
Dr. Caligiuri, I appreciate what you're saying. I had a question, and that is, can you give us the comparative rates of cure of, say, breast and prostate cancer from, say, 20 years ago? In other words, what improvements in the cure rate have occurred in 20 years?
That's a great question. I'm as I mentioned earlier, each of us are subspecialists in one type of cancer, and I happen to be a leukemia physician. So I'm not going to quote you the exact statistics because they undoubtedly will be inaccurate. But what I will tell you is think of 20 or 30 years ago. If you knew anybody who was successfully cured of cancer, at least myself 30 years ago when I was in my mid-20s, I don't think I knew a single person who was cured of cancer. And I, at that time, was in medical school in my residency in Palo Alto and then in Boston. Today, any one of us, and pick any disease, knows someone who is either living successfully or cured of that cancer. And I can think of no better example than breast cancer. It was just, I think when I started, there was one, maybe two drugs for breast cancer. There are now over 10 drugs FDA approved for breast cancer. And so many women now are cured of breast cancer or living successfully with it. So I can't give you the number, but it has to be huge because just a short while ago, it was almost nothing. With prostate cancer, it's a little different because one of the things we've gotten very, very, very good at is detecting it very early. So it would be a little disingenuous of me to say, look at all the people living successfully with prostate cancer. They may have been living successfully with prostate cancer 20 years ago, but didn't know it. Nonetheless, we've made tremendous progress, not curing prostate cancer, except in its earliest stage, But improving the quality of life and, let's say, living successfully with prostate cancer for a long, long time. And we've done that with largely hormonal therapy and now some immune therapy as well. So I put it in the context of 25 years ago, I didn't really know anyone who was cured of cancer or even living successfully with cancer maybe 30 years ago. And today, I think we all know countless people who are either living successfully or cured of cancer. And almost for every cancer, there are a couple exceptions where we've not made any progress, but almost for every cancer.
Mike, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. Becky in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Becky.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
16 years ago, my husband passed away from renal cell carcinoma. And at that time, if you didn't get all of the tumor with surgery, there really wasn't any other alternative. And I wonder if any strides have been made in finding treatment that's been effective in the ensuing 16 years. And I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks, Becky.
Thank you, Becky. Yes, that's a perfect example where every renal cell carcinoma, which is kidney cancer, is not the same. No two cancers are the same or no cancer is routine. At this time, there are a fraction of renal cell carcinomas where when we biopsy them and there are certain genetic mutations, there's a pill you can take, in another instance, an immune therapy you can take, which can cure the cancer or put it into a profound complete remission for a long period of time, even when it's metastatic. So that's a great example where looking at every tumor and looking at it carefully and checking the DNA, we can then go to our armamentarium of drugs and say, well, this tumor should get this, it's called tyrosine kinase inhibitor, or this tumor should have interleukin 2 therapy, which is an immune therapy. And in those instances, we've had remarkable responses of people living for years and years and years with the cancer, and in some instances, curing the cancer.
Dr. Caligiuri, James Cancer Hospital has launched a new social media network called Cancer Connect. I was wondering what it does and how you connect that to how it's helping people.
One of the things that everyone is concerned about, and certainly we at the James are concerned about as well, is that as soon as we have a discovery, as soon as we have important information, we want that communicated not only to our patients, but to their families and the physicians across the country and across the world. So one of the wonders of electronic communication is that you can communicate instantly. And so what we do is we provide tips on cancer prevention, cancer treatment, cancer discoveries through our Cancer Connect newsletter, so that people understand what is going on in terms of the fight against cancer. And they understand it the instant we know about it. And we want people to understand that what we discover here at the James, we share with everyone as soon as it's appropriate. So nothing is withheld. We don't keep secrets about cancer. And that's the purpose of Connect, connecting with people to let them know what's available for them.
Dr. Caligiuri, thanks so much for joining us today. I know you're a very busy guy.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. And like I say, no such thing as a routine cancer. Everyone who diagnosed with a cancer should get a second opinion from someone who's an expert in that cancer before they get treatment.
Dr. Michael Caligiuri will be speaking on campus tomorrow.
That's right.
So you can learn more about that. Go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.